From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College, this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm Jared Nolan.
And I'm Chloe Wittenberg.
This week on War News Radio, Insider's Perspective, we speak with David Sanger, Chief Washington Correspondent with the New York Times.
Libya was sort of the un-Iraq, and by that I meant no ground troops, let other countries take the lead, support from unique American technological assets.
Then we hear from some musicians using their music for activism in the Arab world.
We've given voice to artists all over the world who would not otherwise be allowed to speak out outside their small communities.
Finally, we learn about the practice of dressing girls as boys in Afghanistan.
So we all stayed home for an entire year, and then I would just go out and go to the groceries and come back. And then we figured that we can't live like that forever, because eventually they will figure out that I'm a girl. I'm going to grow up and they can figure it out, and then I can get killed.
But first, a roundup of this week's news.
The Libyan National Transitional Council, or NTC, elected Abdulrahim El-Kaib as the country's new prime minister, replacing Mahmoud Jibril. Jibril had previously promised to resign after Libya's official declaration of liberation, and did so after the victory at Sirte. El-Kaib, a technical engineer and professor at the University of Tripoli, won 21 out of 56 of the council's votes. An NTC spokesman says the council plans to create a new interim government as soon as possible.
The National Transitional Council also says that it will prosecute anyone found to be involved in the killing of former Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi, a departure from their previous statements that Gaddafi had been killed in crossfire. The declaration comes after leaked videos from Gaddafi's captors showed his body being sodomized, which sparked outrage across the globe.
Syria announced it would comply with some Arab League requests for the government to stop attacks on protesters. At an emergency meeting at the Arab League's Cairo headquarters, Syria agreed to halt violence, release prisoners, remove military presence from cities and residential areas, and allow the media to begin covering the situation. On the day of the announcement, at least 19 people were reported to have been killed around the country. So far, the United Nations estimates that as many as 3,000 people have been killed during the seven-month-long uprising.
Israel tested a ballistic missile capable of reaching Iran, the first such test since 2008. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Defense Minister Ehud Barak maintain that Iran poses the greatest threat to Israel and have reportedly been trying to persuade the cabinet to carry out a military strike on Iran's nuclear sites.
This comes as the International Atomic Energy Agency, or IAEA, is due to release a report on Iran's nuclear program. The report will go into previously unseen technical details on nuclear research done in Iran over the past few years. The magnitude of Iran's threat depends upon the rate at which Iran is technologically capable of making weapons-grade uranium out of its current stock of low-grade uranium. The Iranian government, however, maintains that its nuclear program is entirely intended for civilian purposes. Iranian politicians allege that the United States is influencing the IAEA report on Iran, as IAEA Director Yukiya Amano has traveled to the U.S. ahead of the report's release.
Oakland, California police are under formal investigation after Scott Olson, an Iraq War veteran and a member of Veterans for Peace, suffered a fractured skull during the Occupy Oakland protests. Olson appeared to have been struck by a tear gas canister during a clash between police and protesters. His injury has sparked outrage within the Occupy movements, and vigils and general strikes have been held across the country in his name. Olson is still unable to speak and communicates only through written messages.
A suicide bomber rammed a car full of explosives into an armored NATO bus in Kabul, Afghanistan. The attack killed at least 17 people, including 5 NATO service members, 8 civilian contractors, and 4 Afghans. This is the deadliest ground attack against U.S.-led coalition forces since the war began more than 10 years ago. The Taliban later claimed responsibility, although Afghan officials now believe that it's more likely the Haqqani network was behind the bombing. The Kabul attack came on the same day as 2 other attacks in the country. A teenage female suicide bomber wounded several Afghans when she detonated explosives outside an Afghan intelligence office in Kunar province. In Uruzgan province, a man wearing an Afghan National Army uniform killed 3 Australian soldiers and their Afghan interpreter.
Mm-hmm.
This is War News Radio. In October, the United States marked 10 years of war in Afghanistan, saw the death of a dictator in Libya, and announced the withdrawal of all U.S. troops from Iraq, except for embassy personnel. Last week, David Sanger of the New York Times sat down for an exclusive interview with War News Radio's Colin Smith to discuss a decade of American wars.
On September 11, 2001, New York Times chief White House correspondent David E. Sanger was with President George W. Bush as he was visiting schoolchildren in Florida when they received the news that a terrorist attack was underway. Sanger has covered the 10 years of ensuing war, spanning two presidential administrations. Most recently reporting on the Obama administration, Sanger sees a transition to new tactics for addressing such conflicts.
Well, I think what you've seen happen since President Obama took over is that he has begun to lay out a new doctrine of how the U.S. is going about these conflicts.
With all troops scheduled for withdrawal from Iraq by the end of the year, Sanger reflects on the war. The costs were high, but the future seems to promise a more high-tech and collaborative form of intervention that will reduce casualties and prevent complicated occupations. According to a study done by Sanger and his colleagues, the total cost of all U.S. operations in response to 9/11 was $3.3 trillion, almost one-fifth of the U.S. debt.
If you looked at what part of that was in direct response to 9/11, that is to say, putting together Homeland Security, rebuilding the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, compensating the victims, that amount was probably a good deal less than $1 trillion of it.
The rest of the $3.3 trillion price tag was put towards what Sanger called reaction, or, as Sanger noted, some might say, overreaction.
$1.6 trillion of that was really Iraq. A huge bill, hundreds of billions of dollars.
In addition to the monetary cost of the war, Sanger laments the missed opportunities that came from focusing so intently on the Middle East. According to Sanger, this diverted attention hurt America's interests in other areas.
You can't think about doing many peacekeeping operations. You can't think about harder foreign policy problems like dealing with China that don't require troops but do require a huge amount of time and maybe a significant investment.
However, developments in technology may hold an answer. Sanger sees high-tech methods like drones and cyber warfare as ways to both keep costs and U.S. casualties down and to avoid complicated situations like the one the United States is currently winding down in Iraq.
So the idea is move to America's technological advantage and move away from ground wars, which create great resentment from those who feel occupied, and also create an expectation that the U.S. would come in and rebuild the country.
Sanger already sees a model for this type of campaign in the recent intervention in Libya.
Libya was sort of the un-Iraq, and by that I meant no ground troops, let other countries take the lead, support from unique American technological assets.
One of the biggest changes from the Iraq War was America's decision to allow NATO international military forces to take a leading role in the intervention. This isn't something that the U.S. has done much in the past.
NATO had been offering for years, or demanding for years, you know, why doesn't the United States step back and stop being so suffocating and let other countries take the lead? And President Obama was the first one to come along and say, we think that's a fabulous idea. Why don't you guys go do it?
Still, Sanger doesn't see an end to American unilateral involvement in other nations' affairs. What he does predict is for the U.S. to be more prudent in deciding when such involvement is necessary.
The trick here has been to try to sort out in people's minds when it is that the United States still feels that it is both justified and capable of conducting unilateral military action, and when it is that the United States feels that something is not in its direct national interest and it can rely primarily with allies.
It's an analysis supported with 29 years of experience covering U.S. foreign policy. The world has come a long way since Sanger first received the news of the World Trade Center attacks with President Bush. If Sanger is right, America has learned from its mistakes, and the challenges it faced with Iraq are less likely to be repeated. For War News Radio, I'm Colin Smith.
This is War News Radio. As the Arab Revolution continues to reverberate, artists and activists are working to give voice to those struggling with conflict and oppression. War News Radio's Lucia Luna Victoria spoke with a few who are trying to make a difference.
I think in general, I just try to be a voice for the voiceless.
Libyan American rapper Khaled M, currently on a college tour around the U.S., is one of the many communicating the voices of those who have none in times of oppression. Throughout the Arab revolutions, artists are finding ways to make an impact in conflict zones by recording history through their music.
We work with musicians, we work with youth groups, we work with artists in foreign countries, activists in foreign countries who are engaged in using art and music to promote social causes, progressive causes.
Brett Kimberling is a director of Justice Through Music. He directs the organization's operations and works with musicians and groups promoting and exposing youth voice through music for a global audience by means of various media, including social networking and YouTube. Music activism's growing influence on youth is impacting world conflicts as it is a popular means of expression and draws on the experiences of the artists during the times of conflict.
We started Justice Through Music 10 years ago when young people in America were pretty pessimistic and apathetic and didn't think that their voice counted, and we wanted to help them get motivated, and we've worked with many famous artists to talk to them and with PSAs and ads and music, and it's really made a difference.
Kimberling says that a massive number of young people got involved during the last presidential election in the United States.
We've given voice to artists all over the world who would not otherwise be allowed to speak out outside their small communities. I think it's made a real big impact and given a lot of hope to that these artists that their voices are being heard, you know, across the world.
The Activist Resource Group, a branch of the organization Resources for Life, helps provide activists with a support and services that will help them promote positive social change, based in Iowa City. The organization emphasizes and works to empower people to bring permanent healing and peace. Director and founder of Resources for Life, Greg Johnson, explains the importance of music activism.
In the context of religion, you know, at church, synagogue, mosque, you'll often find music, even a football game, there'll be music.
Johnson states the importance of music since it allows a person to soften and clear their mind.
So similarly with activism, we find that music helps people to kind of get an image. It's almost like poetry, you know, set to music, but it helps people to get an image about a certain issue.
Khaled M. supports the idea of helping youth connect their experiences globally.
Right now it happens to be Libyans and Libyan Americans, because I'm familiar with that. But I definitely stand against oppression and injustice anywhere. I think anybody that's going through tyranny or oppression can relate to the music.
He says that when he wrote his song, Can't Take Our Freedom, he purposely refrained from specifying names, such as Gaddafi and Libya.
The only way people knew that that's what it was about was by watching the video. If you just listened to the lyrics and you came from any other country that was facing similar trials and tribulations, you would be able to relate to it.
Freedom of expression is denied in areas of conflict or countries where artists and musicians fear for their lives if they attempt to express their frustrations and the injustices around them. Brett Kimberling shares some of the stories covered by Justice Through Music.
For example, last week we posted an article about a blog post about a musician who was killed in Africa, and we've had people from all over the world come to our site and visit and read all about that, and the musician's actual brother-in-law contacted me to thank us for helping promote the issue and call for accountability for the people who killed that artist.
Kimberling says that artists are often targeted by dictatorial regimes. For instance, earlier this year, a Syrian cartoonist was beaten by pro-regime thugs and his hands broken to prevent him from expressing discontent through his drawings.
We posted about this and called for accountability for the perpetrators of that act. And again, we got people from all over the world coming and reading that and thanking us for supporting that artist. And it allows people to learn about things that happen to artists around the world that they might not otherwise see in the mainstream press.
As opposed to those who fight to get their message out of their country, artists like Khaled M. use modern media to share their music with those in war zones as well as those oppressed within their own communities.
Oftentimes, the people that are downtrodden, the people that are suppressed in society, you know, they don't have the options to share their voice through traditional means. Oftentimes, they can't write in newspapers or become journalists. So we use music to get around that. When you're making music, you can express yourself however you want to.
The influence of activism through music is growing along with globalization. Not only are musicians able to communicate with their local communities, but they are now able to share their music through the internet, allowing for a global audience.
Right now, we're getting a very large audience from the Mideast, from all the countries, you know, Libya, Bahrain, Iran, Turkey, Syria, Tunisia, Egypt. And those activists know that they can rely on us to get their music out and their voice heard in a very honest way.
Kimberlin believes, as does Justice to Music, that musicians are like canaries in a coal mine.
So they are the first to speak out about injustices by their government or their government policies. And so it's important to listen to musicians. They're very sensitive. They're like a very sensitive antennae. And It's very good to listen to them and to allow them to speak for the community at large.
What makes a difference today is the accessibility of this form of expression to anyone in the world the moment it is made. Artists can upload their music to websites such as Justice to Music or Resources for Life, and it will be available to the world public within a week for most cases, since they have to be moderated. Kimberlin plans to continue working as a catalyst in helping the musician's message reach every corner of the world. Rapper Khaled M. has already set up a U.S. college tour called Freedom Tour, which started September 28th and will last until mid-December. Later, he hopes to visit his country, Libya, before starting an international tour. For War News Radio, this is Lucia Luna Victoria.
This is War News Radio. Long after the end of Taliban rule, Afghanistan remains a difficult place to be a girl. In a country recently ranked as the world's most dangerous for women, girls born today face sexual violence, limited access to healthcare, and the trauma of living in a war zone. War News Radio's TiVo looks at the practice through which some Afghan families, in times of need, are dressing their young daughters as sons in a land where cultural barriers make being a male an economic necessity.
Maya was only 6 years old when she became the head of her family. It happened one night in 1991, shortly after the Taliban came into power. After her father, a general in the Afghan army, refused to join their ranks, the Taliban paid a visit to their home in Kabul. Hiding in the bedroom with her four sisters, Maya says even the youngest, who was just 2 years old at the time, remembers everything they heard.
So my dad refused, and then they came over after my dad, and then in front of my mom, they start beating him and forced him to join them, and still my dad would not get convinced, and then they took my dad with them, and we got his body a week after.
Maya, who preferred not to be identified for the story, asked us to call her by a pseudonym. During Taliban rule from 1992 and until 2001, the regime enforced strict laws on the movement and appearance of women in public, including the decree that women must be accompanied by a male relative in order to leave their home. With five daughters and no sons, Maya's family was left in limbo. Most of her extended family had already fled Afghanistan, while those who remained couldn't afford to support them. And so, like many Afghan households, trapped at home with few other options, Maya's mother shaved her head, dressed her like a boy, and sent her into the streets to buy food for the family.
So we all stayed home for an entire year, and then I would just go out and get groceries and come back. And then we figured that we can't live like that forever, because eventually they will figure out that I'm a girl. I'm going to grow up and they can figure it out, and then I can get killed.
These girls are known as bachapoosh, literally meaning boys' clothes in Dari. According to Jenny Nordberg, a freelance journalist and investigative reporter, even after the fall of the Taliban, some women continue to disguise their sex as means of survival, accessing opportunity and assimilating in a hostile social climate.
This is something that most Afghans know about and they're aware of. You know, it doesn't happen in every family, but most have a relative, a friend, a neighbor who has at one point either, you know, been a bachapoosh or had a bachapoosh in the family. And I've met women of all ages, which would indicate that this has been going on for quite a while.
Nordberg first wrote about bachapoosh in a September 2010 article for the New York Times. She's now working on a book based on nearly 2 years of research. Having spoken to dozens of women and their families, Nordberg says there's no one reason why parents choose to make their daughters bachapoosh.
Maybe there was a specific need at the time for someone who could work. Maybe the reason was for the girl to be able to go outside, to get an education. Maybe it was something that the family did for just a few years before the mother in the family had an actual son.
For Maya, need outweighed danger for an entire year, during which she was stopped by the Taliban and questioned a number of times. One time, she was shopping at a neighbor's store when the owner saved her by intervening on her behalf.
He knew that I'm a girl, and, you know, we have no guy in our family, so my mom is doing that. So he's like, oh, leave him alone. He's my son. He basically protected me. And then he came and told my mom that she can't do this to me because they can find out and kill me. And that's when we kind of decided, like, okay, we have to leave Afghanistan.
It took her family another 6 months, waiting for their paperwork to clear and making risky trips to the embassy before they escaped to the country. Each time they left the house, they were harassed and threatened by the Taliban. Her mother bribed many officials in order to secure their visas and passports.
Every time we went out, we had to pay the taxi driver a man to tell the Taliban basically that he's like we are his family, his wife, kids, whatever. So they would protect us that way.
Finally, in 1993, with the money her father had saved, Maya and her family managed to leave Afghanistan and escape to India. Although Maya's experience, and that of many bachapoosh at the time, was defined by Taliban rule, Nordberg emphasizes that experiences can vary greatly. Maya was only a bachapoosh for a year, whereas for many women, the transition back may coincide with puberty. One woman she interviewed lived as a teenage boy until she turned 20 and got married.
Some women have a positive experience. They perceive this as something that has empowered them. Others feel that the added burden of pretending to live like the other gender made things very, very difficult.
Having exhausted all their savings to leave Afghanistan, soon after arriving in India, Maya's two older sisters were forced to marry, while she was forced to learn the language and start working to support her mother and two younger sisters. It wasn't until 2001 that the family came to the United States, and it was only last year that Maya started seeing a therapist. Since then, she's come to terms with her time as a bachapoosh and the loss of her father.
I did counseling without realizing that how much of that affected me. That's when I realized that I was like totally doing my dad's role. I was like my dad, and I realized that I'm not my dad. I was given that role because I had no choice, no option. My mom put me in that position.
Nordberg says while the practice is, for the most part, culturally accepted, not every parent would do it to their own child.
If you were a mother in Afghanistan and you had a daughter, what would you do? Would you think of yourself as someone who did something terrible to your child, or giving her the opportunity of a lifetime?
But Maya doesn't resent her mother for doing what she says was necessary for the family's survival.
It was not a choice, it just she made me do it because that was the only option I guess she thought we had. And everybody was doing it. If you don't have male, that's what you do. You know, you turn your girl to a boy and you just go and get groceries at least. We were just worried about surviving.
In a country that has been embroiled in conflict for much of the last 30 years, many young Afghans have seen nothing but conflict in their lifetime. Maya says much of her memories of Afghanistan are of the war.
people dying in the street. We would hear bombs all the time over our head. We would be in the basement, scared to death that, okay, the next bomb that's going to be fired is going to hit our house and we are going to be dead at the same time.
Now 26, Maya is living with her boyfriend, traveling and working as a nurse in an ER. She says she's very happy and doesn't dwell on her struggles. But Maya doesn't think she'll ever go back to Afghanistan.
I don't have desire to go back. I mean, it's a country that's out of control, even though it's better. But, you know, there's still politics, there's still Taliban, there's still fighting, there's still war. I don't think I would ever go back.
For Nordberg, the endurance of Bachapoosh in modern-day Afghanistan suggests that the suppression of women didn't start or end with the Taliban.
I think I may want to come back with a question, which is, what's bigger trauma, growing up as the other gender or growing up in a war zone? I think the fact that there's still a need today for young girls and women to disguise themselves as the other gender in Afghanistan tells you what desperate situation there is for women in this country.
And for the girls and women of Afghanistan today, it remains to be seen if or when they can come out of hiding. For War News Radio, I'm TiVo.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archive shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Caroline Batten, Eliana Biscard Church, Sarah Blazovich, Rosanna Kim, Amadine Lee, Max Nesterak, and Alan Zhao. I'm Jared Nolan.
And I'm Chloe Woodenberg. Until next time, thanks for listening.